Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. 2021 is just slamming by, isn't it? We're looking down the barrel at Memorial Day just a week or so away. Kind of wish there was a way to just tap the brakes a little bit, slow it down a tad, but here we are, almost to the edge of another summer. Tonight, though, we can collectively kick back and unwind a little bit, chat about some cool and unusual subjects with three guests, all of them first-timers on Coast. In the second half tonight, Laura and Eric Roten, husband and wife investigators and filmmakers who've created an online home for their films and projects. It's called The Paranormal Scholar, and one of the most compelling pieces there is an investigation into a very strange sequence of events in Wales, a strange buildup of military personnel and planes, followed by an equally strange encounter with something very unusual in the sky, followed by massive explosions, physical effects that are still visible today, and a really crummy attempt to cover it all up by the Ministry of Defense. It's a great piece of investigative work, and I know you're going to enjoy hearing about this case, which is ongoing. That's in the second half tonight. First, though, we'll walk along in the shoes of a deputy coroner. You know, people who deal in death, they go to the scenes of deadly accidents, suicides, murders, and handle the often grisly business processing those scenes and the bodies, informing the families and other loved ones. Can you ever get used to that kind of work? Turns out there are profound lessons to be learned from these experiences about life and death and what comes next. And our guest, Donna Frankhart, says that she's had multiple eerie experiences that convinced her and her family that death is not the end, because some of those bodies she handled stuck around, at least in spirit form, even followed her home. I've Seen Dead People is the name of her fascinating and illuminating book. She joins us in just a couple of minutes. Webmaster Ryan Stacey and I have pulled together our usual assortment of items and oddities culled from news media around the world. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it, as always, on the Coast to Coast website. Among the items there tonight, remember that documentary that came out last year right at the beginning of COVID? It was My Octopus Teacher. If you haven't seen it, by all means, check it out. But since that film, there have been a heck of a lot of articles about the intelligence of the octopus, some even comparing them to alien life forms. We have a story tonight that picks up on that idea, a thoughtful piece about how the octopus might change our view of human cognition, along with another story about a lower life form, the tiny but very tough tardigrade, shot from a gun to find out if interplanetary travel can be survivable. My guess is it might be for tardigrades, but they're a lot more hardy than we humans are, that's for sure. And a third animal-related story, some words of wisdom from Dr. Jane Goodall, the world's foremost primatologist, with some suggestions on lessons we should have learned during the pandemic, but probably didn't. If you didn't see Harry Reid's op-ed about UFOs in the New York Times, we have a link to it. Might foreshadow some big things to come in the next couple of months that we'll be talking about here. Those stories and more in Knapp's News. And while you're there on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. If you subscribe for a year, the cost is about 15 cents a day, gives you access to a huge archive of programs and interviews, including the Art Bell Vault. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want. It's a great deal. Ditto for Beyond Belief. That's the name of George Norrie's television program, where George interviews fascinating guests and explores cutting-edge subjects similar to what he does here on the radio. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and the cat and the chicken and the pot-belly pig. Put on a pot of Joe, slide your bod into those silky jammies and your toes into the bunny slippers, plop yourself down in a comfy spot, turn down the lights, and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, Donna Frankhart, I See Dead People, The Diary of a Deputy Coroner. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. For nearly 9 years, Donna Frankhart was a deputy coroner who worked medico-legal death investigations, those involving suspicious, violent, unexplained, or unexpected deaths. She turned to journaling as a way to privately unpack the profound grief that she faced and preserve her own mental well-being. And as she did, she found herself in a conundrum of perplexing relationships with both the living and the dead. Her book is called I've Seen Dead People, The Diary of a Deputy Coroner. It's a heck of a read. Donna, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Well, hello, George. Thank you so much for having me.
Your book pulls few punches. You share, you know, what's going through your mind at each stage of your career, these cases that you see, bodies all over the place. And, you know, I thought it was very honest at every step of the way. Some of it funny and profoundly sad at the same time, but every page genuinely interesting. You let it all loose.
Thank you so much. Yes, I decided, you know, I'm going to put this down on paper, and whether people end up thinking I'm crazy, I'm nuts, they feel sorry for me, they laugh with me, I was hoping that the reader would walk away with positive things, like thinking of how precious life is. I had so much that was in my head and in my heart, and it was eating away at me, it was chipping away, and I needed to process it and compartmentalize it in some way, and that's how I started writing.
Well, that's how it hit me for sure. I mean, you know, obviously the nature of the work, it's grisly, it's gruesome, it's profoundly disturbing in many cases, just the physical parts of what you see. But what comes through to me is exactly what you described, is the importance of life and lessons you can learn from seeing it end, or at least the physical part of an end.
Yes, it's not only the gruesome and gory scenes that you witness, and when you're dealing with death and you're hands-on, it becomes more personal because you're surrounded by this death. And not only that and doing the investigation, but then you have to notify the family, and you're going to give them some of the worst news that they're ever going to hear in their lives, that they've lost a loved one unexpectedly. So you're dealing with the gamut of emotions on top of the gruesome, gory scenes, and it's an emotional roller coaster.
Pardon me to take a personal detour here for a moment, but I remember my first murder scene. It was 40 years ago this month. I was my first weekend working for KLAS. An 18-year-old woman had been a truly innocent person, a straight-A student, a good girl, had been kidnapped, held for ransom, was assaulted, then tossed off an overpass and landed on some rocks 60 feet below. And so it's my first murder scene. We drive to it. There she is down on these rocks. And that just burned into my brain and has never gone away. I ended up working that story for the next 35 years until a killer was brought to justice. And I saw many other murder victims and auto accident victims and dead bodies found here and there over those years. But that first one never went away. And I was wondering if that's what it was like for you, or do you remember all of them?
Well, my first experience with a dead body was as a child. And we were on our way over to Ireland. My mother was originally from Ireland, so we had a lot of family over there. And we'd spend every other summer over in Dublin. And we had stopped in New York to visit or stay with an aunt and an uncle for a few days. And we'd gone swimming, and a body was floating about, I'd say, 20, 25 feet from us. That other kids bumped into this body. And so that was embedded in my memory banks from seeing that bloated body being pulled up off up to shore. And then when I was in my late teens, early 20s, I had an uncle that was murdered. And so we had tragedy affect us, our immediate family, an uncle, and then another uncle that was mugged and stabbed several times. He didn't die right away, but he did basically become reclusive. So in looking back, I'm wondering if that in my subconscious is what led me eventually to the profession that I did, because of such tragedy and seeing bodies, that I wanted to be able to help others in their time of need.
You know, I read the part where you you talk about it still affects you now, years after you've been out of it, but you're driving along, you can't help but look for bodies, and you can't help but remark, oh yeah, I remember picking one up there and getting one in that field over there and that roadside places where there was a bad accident. I do the same thing, but you have so many more thousands of cases where that's true. I mean, are you still living in the same area where you worked?
I am. I'm still living in the same area, and you're right. It's like every street you go down where you're remembering, oh, I remember that case, and oh, I remember that OD, and that one was pulled from that river, and there's just it. They all flash back, and then every time I hear a siren, the adrenaline starts pumping, because even though I'm no longer a deputy coroner, that's been since 2015, it's still in there. I still get that adrenaline going. And even to the point where, and I'm not a doctor, but I can be in a store and I'm walking past people and I'm thinking, oh, he doesn't look too well. I wonder how long he's going to last. Or you look at other people and you think, I wonder what they have in store in their future, how long they're going to live. Because that's the thing. You just don't know what your expiration date is. And it's always swirling around in my head.
And I, you know, of course, I've always wondered about cops, homicide detectives, emergency personnel, coroners, employees like yourself who go to the scene of these things, whether you become immune to it after a while, calloused to it in a sense, or that it, you know, you have to some degree to be able to function, I would think.
Well, and that was a problem of mine, because I took everyone so personal. I looked at each decedent as someone's loved one. They never lost the dignity and respect that they deserved. And so it was someone's mother, father, sister, brother. And then with notifying the family and seeing that devastation and grief, I never really was able to, I was able to do the investigation and focus on the investigation. But then once that was completed and the body was transported, it was on its way, I would sit with the families, and whether they just wanted their hand held for a few minutes, you know, just for a little bit, we'd talk about their loved one, because I wanted them to know that it wasn't just another body for me. And so whether that was the wrong thing to do, I don't believe that it was the wrong thing, because I would hope that if I had a loved one that died tragically, that even if I don't remember the coroner's name, the face, I would remember there was someone there on that day that showed compassion.
And you were advised that various steps of the way, hey, don't take it so personally. You can't let it get to you, right?
Right. But that's the thing. And then when I'd get home after the cases, they'd start to fill up in my brain. I'd be reliving what I'd just done the last several hours. And then I'd have to force myself to stop. You've got to push that out of your brain, because otherwise I'm not going to fall asleep tonight. Or I had two sons. I have two sons. And I didn't want that sadness and grief to overtake me and affect our lives, because we needed happiness. And that's something that's very important to me, is to make sure that you always have laughter in your life, because otherwise, like I said, there was just too much sadness and I didn't want it to overtake me.
Well, it did affect your life, all of your lives, in ways that we'll talk about a little bit later. I want to get into how you were led to this field, because you didn't go to college for this. That wasn't a career plan. You started off doing some volunteer work, and it worked with police agencies helping people in bad situations, right?
Yes. I had gone through a divorce in the early 2000s. My sons were younger, so it would be every other weekend that they'd be with their dad. And I wanted to do something constructive, so that's how I ended up getting on the volunteer team. It was a victim crisis response team, and we would answer pages on calls ranging from anything from death to domestic disturbance. And so it was more on an emotional level to help the families with either making phone calls, making coffee, perhaps giving teddy bears to the children. I had had a little bit of a medical background, and I never thought that I was going to pursue that career any further or go through any more schooling, because my background was always in travel, corporate travel. I did that for over 33 years. And at the time, as I mentioned, with the divorce, I wanted to do something that would be constructive and help the community. And so in being a volunteer crisis responder, I did get to know one of the coroners in one of the counties, and he did see how I handled people, families. And also he would see that every time they needed an extra person to help physically remove the body, if it was a death case, they would ask me, and I, of course, would say, sure, I'll help. And I was intrigued by watching the investigation unfold. It frightened me, but I was very interested. And so I told him if he was ever looking for another deputy, if he would consider me, please give me a call because I'd be very interested. And so about 9-10 months later, I did get a call. He was considering hiring on another deputy, and he wanted me to follow him on all of his, on many of his cases. And he would train me for about another 9 or 10 months, which he did. And at that point, then I was offered the position. I was sworn in and then given the badge, and off I went.
Well, walk us through it. Let's say there's an accident scene. There's multiple fatalities. What you as a deputy coroner would do? You process the scene. You got to be careful that you don't mess it up. If in case there's a crime that was involved there, you have to do some fairly intricate sort of a procedures to gather evidence and materials and then pick up the remains, right? The pieces.
Yes. Well, for example, at a scene, the coroner has possession of the body. The scene is considered a crime scene until the investigation has been completed and it has been ruled out that there's been anything suspicious. The scene is actually under the control of the police, law enforcement. And so then as a team, we work it together. So once I would arrive, would pronounce the time of death, and then, all of the pieces, if the body is in pieces, you need to gather all of that person to be put in one body bag to be sent down for autopsy, or if the body's going to go to the funeral home. The crime scene itself is mainly worked by law enforcement. And then we control the body. So if the body is transported for autopsy, we would attend the autopsy, and then the pathologist would perform the autopsy to determine the exact cause of death. There'd be fluids drawn for toxicology, whether it would be blood, urine, or vitreous, and vitreous is from the eye. Now, if it was not a fatality and it wasn't anything suspicious, but you wanted to rule out and draw some fluids, then I would, my preference was to draw vitreous fluids, and then they'd be sent off for toxicology. But the crime scene is more worked by the police and the law enforcement. Like I said, between law enforcement and the deputy or the coroner, we would complete that investigation to determine what the cause was.
That work is not for everyone. And there's a part in your book where you talk about, drawing out that fluid out of someone's eye, the body of a dead person, their eye, and there are onlookers there who give you the strangest look after you finish your job. I mean, they look at you like a ghoul, I guess, at times, or in awe, or a combination of the two.
Yes, you're usually, there would be, well, as far as people onlooking, it would be mainly the police. If there's any family there, then we would usually ask them to, we would have them out of the room because we wouldn't want them to see us doing what we need to do to their loved one. But, yes, there's always someone watching.
I have been on crime scenes where the media, us, arrive, and then the family gets there later. Oh, man, that's a really bad scene. They really look at us like were voyeurs or something and really get angry in those kind of situations. So I can imagine, you wouldn't want family members there for that kind of a situation. We're talking with Donna Frankart about her book, I've Seen Dead People. We're going to share some of the lessons she's learned at these scenes, profound lessons that have stuck with her all this time, and then get into some of the really strange encounters that happen after bodies are processed. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast. Kind of scene that my guest, Donna Frankart, has been to many times over the years and drawn to the work, a work that many of us just couldn't do. She was drawn to it because of the empathy that she showed in dealing with the families and loved ones who lost people along the way. When we come back, we're going to get into conversations about some strange, eerie events that started to happen in her life and that followed her home right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Donna, you know, look, reading your book, it's a job that is really tough that most of us could not handle. But, you know, you did it. It's necessary. It's a tough job that has to be done. And especially the part about informing the families, the loved ones. Good gosh, that is brutal. And you describe it in very frank terms in the book.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was so difficult. It's to tell someone that their loved one, whether it was a child to even someone that's elderly, because even though they've had a long life, it's the matriarch of the family, and it changes the whole dynamic of the family. It was very difficult, and I thought actually through all of the notifications that I did and the death that it would be somewhat easier for me when I lost my parents, and it wasn't any easier. It's very difficult.
Your first death case was a suicide, and you know I think one of the lessons about the suicide, how you know what you see at these scenes where the people take their own life very selfishly in many cases, where they just don't care what's left behind, the mess that's left behind, how it will affect the people mm-hmm. around them. I mean, literally a mess because of the methods that they use.
Yes. Oh, it, you know, that's such a debate between people, whether suicide is a selfish act or if it's just that they can't see beyond whatever pain they're dealing with. And you know, that the family or the loved ones that are left behind are the ones that are now going to suffer because of the loss. It's yeah, tough debate, but boy, that first call was, oh my God, time stood still. It was not something that I was prepared for. And it was, for a first call, that was like hitting the ground running. It was very sad.
And of course, the, you know, the ultimate lesson is that you learn if you're in the death business is how precious life is. And, you know, infants that die and they're, you know, or family members and you don't get a chance to say goodbye, or people who die alone. You have a lot of those kind of cases in your book that are sad, but it's there. The positive lesson from it is, you know, reach out while you're here. Right.
Yes. And I every chapter I did have a takeaway that I tried to think of something positive out of it. I know it sounds strange to say that there might be something positive out of a death, but I, for my own sanity also, and hoping that the reader would walk away thinking of the positives, that so someone has lost a loved one, well, perhaps it brought a family together. It opened their eyes to realize that no one knows when their last day is going to be. You've got your date of birth, your date of death, so make the most of it in between.
You started having some pretty strange experiences. Let's talk about the first one, because you started to work for a funeral home, and, you know, you're there early in the morning, you're there late at night. Sometimes you arrive and it's dark, and you leave and it's dark, and you're thinking, I'm the only one here. Eventually, you learn that's not really true, right?
Oh, yes, boy, that's where things get weird. I was working at a funeral home and then also a deputy coroner, so I was around death 7 days a week. And in the winter when it's dark in the morning and I'd be opening up, well, if the funeral directors did not have a funeral that day or they were maybe out on calls, I'd be the only one in this funeral home. And it was about a 100-year-old building. It was an old English Tudor, so there were a lot of bodies that went through there. I could walk in the morning and hear voices and think, oh, there's a director, two directors that are already there that morning. I'd turn on every light, and I also had to be careful because I might walk into a room, there might be a body and a casket set up for a service that day. So it wasn't like walking into the 9-to-5 job where you just have to worry about finding your desk. You didn't want to bump into bodies. But I would hear conversations, voices. I'd find feathers on the floor in the middle of summer, so it wouldn't have been a feather from down jackets. So I would think it would be somebody's guardian angel or angels, but a lot of orbs. The owner of the funeral home, one day I was walking back to my office, and I heard her running behind me, and there was like a commotion of excitement, and I turned, and I said, what's wrong? And she said, oh, my God, did you see him? See who? Well, see the man that was walking behind you. And she described what he was wearing. He had the khaki pants, the white shirt, you know, blonde hair. And then he turned and he went into one of the viewing rooms. She was so excited because she said, I have waited 20 years to see someone, something. And I'm so happy because funeral directors were all the ones that I worked with and at this funeral home. We're always very respectful of the dead, and it was a very serious business. But she was so excited and was like, that was the start of it. Then things started happening all of the time, not only, as you mentioned, at the funeral home, but in my home.
So are you talking about this with your coworkers, other than that lady who saw the guy behind you? Is it the topic of conversation? Do you ask the people you're working with, hey, does this happen all the time? Have you seen something? In general, it seemed like they were kind of laughing it off and dismissing it, at least some of them, right?
Well, the one that was laughing it off and dismissing the fact when I told her that I heard voices when I opened up one morning, a little later in the day, her and I, and she was a funeral director. We were sitting in the front of my office, and we heard voices. And she said, she said she would go to check to see if someone had come in. And we had bells on the front of the door and the back door so that if any family members or anyone came in, we'd hear people coming into the building. But we didn't hear any bells. But she said, well, I'll get up and check. And so she went off. She came back into the office, and she had that look. And she said, there's no one here. And I looked at her like, yep, who's laughing now? Those are probably the same voices I heard when I opened up this morning. And there was another time that same director it was in the middle of the night. She had a case where she had to bring the body in, and she was prepping the body. And someone started banging on the other side of the door, the outside of the care center, it was called, which is where the bodies were stored and where they do the embalming and the preparation. And she opened the door, and it was in the middle of the night, and there was no one there. So there are many funeral people in the death industry that do experience the spirits. Now, whether they want to admit it or not, you know, that's another story. I think a lot of them probably don't, because they don't want to scare people from either going through that funeral home or just scare people in general. And I'm not trying to scare people either. It's just that was just what I experienced, all of these spirits. And I look at it that we leave our bodies behind, but we still have that energy, and our souls will continue on. It was unnerving, but it was just, I tried to look at the positive things, like it's someone's soul and it's good energy. And I was lucky that it was good energy.
So you hear voices, you hear entire conversations. Did you ever see a specter floating around in the funeral home? We'll get to your home in a minute, but floating around a body or what used to be a body. I know at some point in your book, you mentioned about families, loved ones would be there and see souls actually leave the body. You ever see anything like that?
At the funeral home, I mostly would, if you've ever smelled death, there's a distinct It's a smell that you, once you've smelled it, you'll never forget it. And many times I would be in the office and that smell would come in and I knew that someone was there. As far as, there would be a lot of orbs, we'd see little orbs floating around, but I, in the funeral home, did not see the actual whole bodies or any spirits. Just heard their voices, the orbs, the feathers, the smell of death.
The smells could take other forms, too. You mentioned somewhere in the book about the smell of somebody who smoked cigarettes. You mentioned about somebody who drank beer. And those smells would come to be associated with particular people that you had processed or worked with. Right? It didn't smell like death. It smelled like something else.
Yes. There was a service for a gentleman that owned a tavern or a bar. And the day of his service, his visitation and service, the family had brought in all of the paraphernalia from that bar, the tavern, which was his business for, you know, all of his life, many, many years. And so they brought all of these, like, bottles and light fixtures and whatever else was in this tavern and set it up throughout the room. And probably a few weeks later, so the service was done, he was gone. A few weeks later, the scent of beer, a very strong, strong smell of beer, was floating into the rooms, and it was just very strong and pungent, and I just, you know, we knew he was there. He must have stopped in.
But you mentioned about the smell of death. What's that smell like? Just that smell by itself. It just is a pungent. It's acrid.
It's like a sweet but rotting. Oh boy, like rotting, decaying flesh, like old meat, you know, when you smell old meat that's spoiled, but then there's also like a sweetness to it. It's just very different. It's different.
You weren't creeped out too much about it after a while at the funeral home, but then things start following you home and attach themselves to you that are seen by you in your home and by your kids, your family. Tell us how that evolved. What was the first incident and then proceed from there?
You bet. And George, would it be okay for me to mention that particular funeral home, after a while, I was wearing a cross, a rosary, or keeping one in my pocket, just because I felt like that would protect me more. And there was a lady that worked at the funeral home, and she told me not too long ago that she brought a medium in there, and the medium walked right into one of the viewing rooms, put his hand up on the wall, started shaking uncontrollably, hightailed it out of the funeral home, and told her he would never go back in there again, and he wouldn't tell her what he was feeling. And I thought to myself, had I known that back when I was working at that funeral home, I would have been long gone. But I was told also by other mediums that because I was doing the work for God, that I was like a beacon of light to the spirits. And so many of them, because of the cases that coroners work on, which are the unexpected or suspicious or their tragedies, most of them, that many people, these bodies, they don't realize that they're dead, or they don't know what to do, they don't know where to go, and they kind of hover around. So a lot of the souls would follow me home. Most of them didn't cross over the threshold, but some of them did, and some of them attached to me because, as I was told, because I showed such compassion at the scene, that they just attached to me. So there were so many things that started happening at home. For example, a figure, like a mist of a silhouette, like a shadow of a shape that I would see, or that I had seen one night when I was in the middle of the night. I'd gone in to use the bathroom, came out, and And I thought it was one of my son. I thought it was odd, but I thought maybe one of my sons was playing a joke. I don't know why I was thinking that, because it wasn't making sense that there'd be this black figure right outside of the bathroom. And so I stood there like, okay, this isn't funny. It's the middle of the night, and the thing didn't move. And so I put my hand out, and I went right through it. And that was one of my first experiences. Would you like me to tell you some other ones?
Or? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Keep going.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay, and so then another night I was in bed. I hadn't fallen asleep yet, but my eyes were closed. I was trying to, you know how you go to bed and you have so many things racing through your mind and you try to push it out. So I felt like somebody was looking at me. You know, you have that feeling like somebody is there. And so I opened my eyes, and above me was an old man's face. And he looked angry, and it was a head, and then the back was shaped like a sphere. And he was just looking, kind of floating above me, looking down. And I panicked because I thought, oh, my God, somebody broke it. My sons were at their dad's. I thought somebody had broken in and they were going to harm me. So I quick threw the covers over my head. And then I thought, oh, that's stupid. I have to be able to see what he's going to do, right, if he's going to hurt me. So I brought the blanket back down. And he was still looking down at me. And he had that puckered lip, you know, his lips were puckered and he was mad. And then he just slowly turned and he shot across the room and he disappeared. And the funny thing about that, it's not funny. I mean, it was terrifying, but that head followed us to the next place that we moved to. And the next time he appeared was in front of one of my sons, and I have that in the book. And my son, being in high school or just out of high school, he looked at it differently. I mean, they were used to these orbs that would bounce off curtains and knock over pictures, and he was walking up the stairs to his bedroom, and he hadn't turned the light on. But he said, he told me after the fact that there was this really ugly looking old guy who was at the top of the steps, and he just punched out at him and he disappeared.
We're talking with Donna Frankhart about her book, I've Seen Dead People. Donna, just for future reference, pulling the blanket over your head only works for protection against monsters, not against ghosts. So that's a rule I learned as a kid. We'll be right back with more stories of things that she and her family saw at home that sort of followed her from the funeral home and home from work. Much more to come here about I've Seen Dead People, Diary of a Deputy Coroner,